Every little bit of advantage is my motto, you know, and I'll work hard for days just to make some small improvement in a song. And the trick is really not to reveal the work, because it has to feel like it was the most natural thing in the world when anybody hears it. So even by talking about it now, I'm slightly undoing the magic, perhaps.
Welcome to Behind the Set List, the podcast where artists tell the stories about the songs they play live. I'm Glenn Peoples from Billboard. My co-host Jay Gilbert from Label Logic was not able to join me to record this introduction, but we were both able to speak with the amazing Neil Finn of Crowded House, best known for such songs as Something So Strong and Don't Dream It's Over. Crowded House is back with a new album, Gravity Stairs, out May 31st through BMG. The first single, Oh Hi, was released in February. It can be found at your favorite digital platform. You're listening to it now. Go check it out. Neil talked about the recording of the new album, many different aspects of the band's concerts, and he told us about a restaurant tour Crowded House did to promote the debut album. And Jay was actually at the Seattle show. Very interesting. So without further ado, here's Neil Finn from Crowded House on Behind the Set List.
Neil, thank you so much for joining us today. It's good to see you.
Nice to see you.
So we'd like to talk about your set list, but we'd really like to talk about, you have a brand new album, Gravity Stairs, comes out May 31st. The cover reminded me a little bit of Revolver. Tell us about what is Gravity Stairs, and talk about the new album.
Well, that's a big question there, because that's quite covers a lot of ground. Gravity Stairs is the new album for Crowded House. We've been making it for the last couple of years, with a combination of live sessions that we managed to fit in between touring, because we're all spread out at different ends of the globe. Nick Seymour, our bass player, lives on the west coast of Ireland. Elroy, my drummer son, lives in London. Liam, the guitar player, and also my son, lives in LA, and Mitchell Froom's in LA, and I'm in New Zealand. So somehow we're testing the theory of how far apart you can be in a band and still be really united. It's a combination of some live sessions, and then we go off and do our little private pouring over these sessions and sending them to each other. Gravity Stairs relates to an actual set of staircases that is in a place where we holiday sometimes, these big, heavy stone stairs, and we all swear that there's a huge iron deposit underneath that's dragging us down, trying to drag us down. And at the top of the stairs is a little balcony where we have tended to have quite a lot of big sing songs with a Greek band that that lives in the town with us. So the reward at the top of the stairs is a place of great merriment and enjoyment. And but you've got to work hard to get there. And that's sort of a metaphor for life, really, I think. And yes, and to follow on the other part of the question, the cover that Nick Seymour has done, he was a huge fan of the when he was at art school, and actually just at secondary school, he used to do those kind of pen and ink drawings. Klaus Voormann did the cover of Revolver. And so it's a homage to some degree and a reminder to him of a kind of a style of cover that he loved and he grew up on. It's a portrayal of his roots.
Tell us about the songs. Were these written specifically for the album? Were they songs that have been kicking around and you recorded for this album specifically?
They were written around that. We knew we were about to make a Crowded House album, and it's always a case of gathering in the ideas that are around at the time. Some of them are quite fully formed, and the band takes them and learns them, actually in many cases transforms them. And some of them are just sort of mere slips of ideas, and then the band takes them and helps to form them into songs. That's the beauty of a band. It's a shared process, and sometimes the band, the individual members will play things completely different than how you would have imagined. I think that lets light into the idea, stops it becoming an artifice that's like one single man's view. So that's the glorious thing about bands.
You know, the first track you released, Oh Hi, that was released February 8th. I saw a couple of different music videos. There's one with the with your head on this little kid's body dancing around, which is just absolutely joyful. You can't watch it without smiling. But then I saw this other video where you recorded, you, Crowded House, recorded with the BBC Orchestra, just a beautiful rendition of Oh Hi. Talk a little bit about those two different videos.
Well, the video with the, I had the idea of putting my head on a child's body because my grandson, Buddy, is a really quirky dancing style, and it's kind of mad and fantastic, but really uncoordinated. And it occurred to me that no adult would ever dance like that. So there would be some good humor and good, vent to put my head on him, but he wouldn't cooperate. So we had to hire a semi-professional kid in New York to go and, but I think it worked out well because they were able to direct him. He was being hired and paid. It was just a nice idea, and it's kind of absurd, obviously, but I think the fact that the head is kind of slightly cardboardy, and we're not trying to fool anybody, we're just trying to create a sort of a humorous version of, well, the song has got quite a lot of joy written into it. It was inspired by children, these children at some schools in Africa that I've been connected with, the organization that helps the education of a few of them. And I got to know some of these kids, and it really inspired the song. And so I want to keep that mentality going. And it's sort of about the joy of observing children, being part of their story, creating a good environment for them, then actually getting a lot back from that. You know, you get a lot, learn a lot, you remember a lot. That's what the song's all about.
And what about the BBC Orchestra version? Tell us a little bit about that. That was amazing.
We were just there last week. We played live on BBC Two with this orchestra. It's a thing they do called Piano Room. And Nick Seymour and I just did it with the two of us rather than the whole band, because we, circumstances dictated that. But also we thought, well, if you're going to play with an orchestra, you want to give them full rein, really. We didn't want to drown them out with drums and bass and just tack them on the top. So a friend of mine, Victoria Kelly, did a beautiful arrangement, and it was really kind of full on because it's live and we only get to run through the thing with the orchestra for two rehearsals, so that you're on the edge of your seat. But it was something really beautiful about it, and I think it turned out well. So any song should be able to be redefined. That song is destined to be redefined quite a few times, because I'm sure when we get on stage, it's going to come through another transition.
Yeah.
You've been playing this song since last year, at least last year, in your sets.
That's right.
Have you played other songs as well from this album?
I think we on the last US tour, we played maybe three or four new songs a night, depending on the night. We had already got to the point where the album was finished, so we had the arrangements down. It's so nice to take finished songs to stage, because you've done a lot of the hard work's been complete. You know the arrangement fits together well, and then there's the great joy of adding some live energy to it. We got a taste of these songs going to be great to play on stage.
What's it like as the musician playing a new song for people who haven't heard it yet? Now it's online. People can see the videos, different versions of it, stream it on Spotify or whatever. You know, a year ago, they hadn't heard it. And so what's it like to take fresh material to an audience?
Well, we were greatly encouraged by the response we got from the new songs on this last tour. We were doing Oh Hi, we were doing Life's Imitation, and quite often another one or two during the night. We really sensed a great willingness to get into these new songs. Not always the case. Obviously, there's danger of get up and go to the bar kind of moments in shows when you put a new song in there. But our audience seems very receptive to the idea that we're an evolving unit. One of the nice things about moderate levels of success is that the people that come and see you are all there and for the long haul, generally. They're not coming because it's an event connected to a recent hit. That means you get license, and they like when you go deep, and we like to change things up a little bit. So it also means we can present new songs without feeling like we're losing the audience.
One of the songs that you played on this last run that's from the album, The Howl, Your son Liam sings lead, and he's got a wonderful voice. And as a father, I can't help but think what that must be like for you to be playing the song and to look over and see your son perform. There must be a lot of pride there.
There is, yeah. Well, the band has also now put enough work on, and everyone's had their own experience, Liam and Elroy, of music, that we come together very much as equals. And I guess I'm always, as the lead singer, lead man, I'm only going to have a little bit of a power of veto. But generally speaking, the band is very integrated. And, yeah, I love looking over and seeing Liam just lead the audience on. And he's also, he was opening up the show on that tour, the audience were really leaning into the show by the time we got there, because he has a very engaging stage presence. And he was actually debuting a headset mic on that opening slot. And so it was sort of like a cross between a TED talk and a comedy routine and a live music show. But it's inspiring for me to watch. He's got his own thing going.
You signed with BMG in February, and you know, artists have so many options these days for, you know, label deals, distribution deals, self-releasing. Mm. What are you looking for in a record label at this point in your career?
Well, it's a really nice feeling to have a worldwide release on the same label, having had a lot of records where we've had bits and pieces and a deal here, different deal there. To coordinate those deals are very tricky, and I admire people who set about their own releases, but it's a huge job as well. So we have the focus and attention of the record company, and it's our first record with them, and I've noticed already how wonderful it is to have that feeling of coordination and support. In a way, it's kind of it's an old-fashioned notion to have a record company behind you. These days, you sort of tend to sub out quite a lot of the roles, like promotion and even the marketing management has taken a lot larger role in that whole thing, record companies. But it's a partnership, you know. It always, if you allow those people in, and actually, there's a lot of music enthusiasts that work in record companies. Some of the people maybe they're focused on more corporate things, but largely people join record companies because they're music enthusiasts. So if you acknowledge that and get to know them, there's possibility of great results, the sum being greater than the parts, you know?
Yeah, indeed. So this set list, well, like a lot of crowded house set lists, there's this sort of unpredictability. You know, I've seen shows where you have Mean to Me very close to the beginning of the show, seen shows where it's near the end. Talk about your process when you're creating a set list. Does it vary just on your mood, how things are going, the venue itself? What is that process for you when you sit down to decide what songs you're going to play? Because it's sort of an embarrassment of riches. You've been doing this a while. There's a lot of great material to choose from. How do you craft that playlist?
Yeah, that's the tricky thing, is having an abundance of things we feel like playing. So you have to mix things up. We traditionally have tried to put a different set together every night. Certain times we stick to relatively close format because we're beginning a new phase perhaps, and we haven't learned how songs work together yet. But as the tour goes on and we get more confident and there's more trust in the band, I can write quite different set lists every night. And I think we did get to a point in the old days, and we're starting to approach it again, where the band's so confident and being able to get off the script, is that we'll enjoy diversions and accidents happening and even mistakes, because they lead you somewhere more memorable. You can see the audiences when anything's obviously off script, they kind of lean forward going, okay, something's happening. This is not planned. And I do think that's a joy for most audiences to get, to get that kind of involvement where they don't know what's going to happen next.
What's your thought on mixing in new songs versus kind of the songs that you know everybody's going to be familiar with, and songs that people might show up, you know, demanding to hear? You always play a lot of new songs, at least the set list that I've looked at. But then you have some songs that are, I'm going to guess, are pretty standard and you're always going to play. So how do you approach that mix of old and new?
Yeah, it gets tricky to mix in ones that are sort of the crowd favorites that weren't hits, but there's huge body of support for, you know, or pockets of support for different songs sometimes. So we try and mix in, you know, I'm quite happy to play most, if not all, of the really well-known songs because I'm still like them and feel relieved that they're not getting tedious after this long. We might leave the odd one out. It's healthy to leave even well-known songs out every now and again because then you come back and you get a fresh enthusiasm for them. We like to try and put some of the like one or two obscure songs in here and there, just as little Easter eggs, I suppose, for people that have been long-term supporters. And then there's like a brace of songs that I would regard as, you know, they weren't hits particularly, things like Private Universe that just seem really important in the set because it allows the band to stretch out in a different way. It's usually in the middle of the set somewhere. And it's fun to jam on, you know.
Yeah, they seem like they're always fresh. I read this quote from you where you said, "I've always been afraid of repeating same old formulas." And there's something very interesting about Crowded House and Finn music. You know, for me anyway, I'll listen to an album, let's say it's Temples of Low Men, and I'll think, oh, well, that's, you know, that's not like Crowded House, but then it becomes my favorite album. And then I'll listen to Woodface and I'll go, well, you know, that's not like Temple, but then it becomes my favorite album. And this is sort of a cycle that repeats itself. And I remember when I first heard Together Alone, I had that same reaction, but now it's like my all-time favorite Crowded House record. Maybe it's just the layers of this onion that you're crafting, but talk about that fear of sort of repeating that same old formulas.
Well, it's just the fascination of what music can offer up if you don't get caught in repetition. And, you know, I'm sitting around, I'll add a different instrument to my writing process. But it is surprise. I'm always kind of get excited about an idea that I haven't heard before. And sometimes familiar things start to pop into the arrangements. You know, there's things that you do that are inherent that always going to feel good to you. But the most rewarding thing is to listen back at the end of the day of writing to something that has some fresh angle on it that you don't know where it's come from. It's informed by what you've been doing, I suppose. It's all very indirect, though. I don't ever sit down and go, oh, this is the kind of thing I want to do now. This is the style of music that I'm interested in. It always ends up emerging out of shadows and little shafts of light that come into the process, sometimes after days of just looking at a pretty blank page or an empty computer screen, and then all of a sudden, just because you turned up and put the hours in, what can be a simple, banal idea turns into something golden because you move one thing, you know. So it's a fascinating process. It really is.
You know, I got thinking about your songwriting process the other day. I was looking over the set list, and this is May 30th in Boston. May 30th, 2023 yeah. was the set list we were looking at. And you play a number of songs from your 2021 album, Dreamers Are Waiting. Uh-huh. And one of those songs is Playing With Fire, which sounds like a, you know, a serious song that some of the lyrics are, let's all be quiet, the next generation is talking. But it's also kind of a peppy song, upbeat. Mm-hmm. And I got to wondering, you know, how do you pick a tempo for a song like that? I was thinking of the Netflix documentary We Are the World, where Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson started writing this song, and they thought of what kind of song it might be, an anthemic and sing along, and they picked the tempo right away. It seemed to be the first thing they started with, and I thought, well, if that song was faster, maybe it would sound too angry, or if it was too slow, maybe it's not exactly a tearjerker. So how do you pick a tempo for a song that seems to, you tell me if I'm missing it, seems to have an important message.
Sometimes that varies a lot from the initial writing. You know, I'm well used to songs evolving in quite dramatic ways from initial instincts. And I've got demos of songs on this record and the last one that if you listen to, you go, wow, that really made a big change. Like just by trying stuff out, you know, like this song, Ohio, that's the first single off the new record, started as quite a slow, it had a kind of a similar feeling in the chorus to what it has now, where there's something about the way that the harmonics of it was quite fresh and different for me. And then I just kept speeding it up. In fact, it was, we recorded a version at, right at the beginning of the process that was, I think it was 120 BPM, accidentally, not particularly deliberately. And then I just didn't feel like it was quite upbeat enough. And so I ended up remaking it twice, actually, at about 124 BPM, which it is currently now. It seemed too fast initially, and then I just learned how to sing it like that. Every little bit of advantage is my motto, you know, and I'll work hard for days just to make some small improvement in a song. And the trick is really not to reveal the work, because it has to feel like it was the most natural thing in the world when anybody hears it. So even by talking about it now, I'm slightly undoing the magic, perhaps.
There's a section in the middle of the set list where the band performs a couple of songs, Four Seasons in One Day, Sister Madly, and they do that back to back. But, you know, Elroy is on the snare and brushes, sort of like Paul used to do, and I thought that was a beautiful nod to the past. Talk about that little section there, those two songs. I find a lot of joy in that section.
Yeah, I love bringing Elroy out front. The thing is that Paul Hester taught Elroy how to play brushes, so Elroy, well, Elroy observed him. We tried out a whole lot of drummers years ago when we had a second incarnation of Crowded House. And the one thing that we found, some brilliant drummers, but almost, we couldn't find anybody that played brushes quite like Paul. He just had a particular style, a swing in it, in the way he did it. And Elroy was the only person I know that can really do it in a, you know, a very similar manner. Bringing him down the front just changes the emphasis of the whole show. We really became a band by playing in small venues, kind of as a busking style outfit. We learned how to sing together like that. At a point when nobody really took much notice of Crowded House, we turned a lot of people on through turning up in people's lounge rooms and restaurants and promotional things as a three-piece busking thing. So it's very much part of our DNA. That part of the show is really important. I hope we can enlarge upon that. I mean, I'm not saying that we were responsible. It now seems like quite a common thing for bands to have a little acoustic set in the middle of their show. And, you know, we were at a point early in the, you know, late 80s doing that. And at the time, nobody much was. So it's nothing new about playing acoustic. I can't claim that. But it has always been something that's been close to our hearts.
I actually got to see one of those early shows like that. When the debut album came out, you did a promotional run, like you were talking about restaurants. And I was at Salty's in Seattle, which, for those that don't know, it's right there on the waterfront, right? And you guys played, and it was, I mean, I photographed it. It was just a lot of joy in the room. Everybody was having a great time. What do you remember about Salty's or that sort of early promotional run?
I remember that really fondly. And I think there was a girl from the record company called Astrid that...
Yeah, Astrid Guldenman.
Yeah. That was really lovely, and we got on really well with. And all of those shows just felt like people turned up not really knowing why they were coming to a restaurant to see a band on Capitol. And, you know, they were prepared to give it the benefit of the doubt. I think everybody left those shows feeling like they'd had a rocking good time, beyond what they thought. And we found it far more exhilarating to do those things than we probably, on paper, playing a whole lot of restaurants didn't seem overly glamorous, you know. But we did a Japanese restaurant in LA, Yamashiro's. We played an Indian restaurant in New York, overlooking Times Square. And they were all pretty riotous, you know, really pretty wild affairs in the end.
So what's your sweet spot now? What kind of, and that's, maybe it varies by country, but in the United States, what kind of venues do you like performing in these days?
Well, we had a run of venues last year that you've referred to, the Wang Theater in Boston, and there's some extraordinarily beautiful rooms to play at that size. So I would say they are probably my favorite. They are just a beautiful sense of theater in a place like that, which we take advantage of, hopefully. And that amount of people is a really lovely amount to relate to, but there's no rules. And as we've been talking about doing these little restaurant, you know, sometimes a small room is really, really fun. And I've had great nights in arenas. But I'd say theaters, that size theater is pretty hard to beat.
And that's probably 2,000, 2,500.
Something like that, yeah. Then there's some in America and actually elsewhere. There was a period in the, I guess, the early days of cinema where they were building these beautiful theaters. There was a sense of occasion about going to the cinema, and they've all been transformed. All the good ones have been transformed. Some of those Fox theaters and that have been into most gorgeous venues. We feel pretty lucky to get into those rooms.
You know, for me, there's maybe a dozen or so songwriters ever who can paint sort of an unexpected picture or bring you to your knees with their lyrics. You know, the Bernie Taupins of the world, Bob Dylan, Elvis Costello. And I put you in that group, and you've been consistent throughout, you know, the early days, the Split Ends, Message to My Girl, you know, all the way till today. Where does that lyrical talent or drive come from?
It's a very flattering company you've just put me in. I don't really feel like I'm a natural lyricist in the same way that those people you mentioned are, in the way that they can tell a tale. But I'm aspiring to be that good, you know. And it takes a lot of work. And sometimes you get a whole run of, you get like a verse and a chorus suddenly pop into your head with a melody and very quickly. And it's glorious when that happens, because you know the words are really tied to the melody and they're always meant to be. And I rely on a lot of subconscious imagery coming out, and I don't necessarily know what the song's about to start off with, but I start to look at these things that have been gifted, I would say, and I can see some kind of thread emerge from them. And then there's a lot of hard work about connecting the dots. And to get to a point where, like I referred to before, where it feels like the work is not revealed and you feels like it's the most natural thing in the world, and those, they'd always existed like that. And even the sound of the words to me has to evoke images that aren't necessarily connected to the literal meaning of the words. That's the great success of a lyric, when it just opens up a door for people and for their own thoughts. I think I don't like to spell it out too much. I like it when there's little anomalies and you know, an abstraction in the lyric.
Yeah. Do you have any favorites?
Well, we did a song on the piano room in London this recent, Four Seasons in One Day, which I'm very fond of. But you know, there's other ones. I try and make them as good as I can. And people like Leonard Cohen and you know, other people that I think I would aspire to. But you know, he's a master. I'm willing to accept that I'm not quite up to that level as a lyricist, but then perhaps I have some melodic strengths that some of the best lyricists don't have. So, you know, I'm not being too falsely modest either.
I think your strength as a songwriter is that you make it sound effortless. What you're saying is it's not. There's a lot more work that
I think that's
goes into it.
I think everybody that work that you admire has a work ethic that's pretty obsessive.
For sure.
Yeah.
Back in the early Crowded House tours, I mean, they're always fun. They're always unpredictable. But I remember if Nick or Paul would play a part of a song, you'd say something like, you know the rule, you start it, you finish it. And I saw that happen a lot. And I'm wondering, you know, talk about that rule a little bit, and do you still enforce it?
Yeah, depending on what mood I'm in, I suppose. But like I said before, we're always looking for a little spontaneous moments and accidents to happen. So if somebody does venture forth, I will definitely want them to pursue it rather than there being an awkward sort of return to reality necessarily. And sometimes it doesn't end well. You know, that all of our adventures are not necessarily successful. But, you know, Nick, for instance, might start singing, you know, the beginning of Pale Blue Eyes or something, and I'll make him finish it. He knows at least a verse and a half of it. So, I'll push him on.
You know, the good people who fill out these set lists at setlist.fm add, when people cover songs or include brief snippets in songs. And in this concert in Boston, it says there's a brief snippet of the Bee Gees' Night Fever and Weather With You.
Oh, right.
Is that somebody just going off on a little tangent? You played a few bars of Night Fever.
Yeah, I kind of remember that. It's the only time I've ever done that and Weather with you, but I sort of vaguely remember that moment where sometimes you're in the middle of that, would have been towards the end of the song, I dare say, and there's sort of a free moment where it just breaks down to feel, and it's welcome to all comers at that point. If somebody gets an idea or something that'll fit that feel, then we'll take that on. I can't remember who started that off, but I do remember that moment. See, that's the good thing about having the ability to step off the script, is that it makes you remember particular shows. And I don't know how bands that or artists that do the same show every night have any memory of one show from the next. You know, we do remember, somebody will come along and remind me of a show where, you know, maybe somebody got up and sang a particular song or whatever, and I go, oh yeah. And they say, you actually do have you retain a memory.
You're sort of bringing a little bit of New Zealand into your music from time to time, you know, from maybe beginning with Mean to Me. I'd never heard of Te Awamutu before that, and I certainly know where it is now. Talk about, you know, growing up and sort of bringing that, you know, your childhood sort of into your music.
Yeah, well, we're all connected to the landscape that we grew up around and the environment we grew up around. So that's always in there, and it's not in a specific or obvious way in many ways, but there's something about the way the light hits the hills that just kind of brings some feeling to light, you know, when you're making music. And like I say, you can't really verbalize it beyond that. But something you aspire to in the atmosphere you create, yeah, it comes from where you are. And I live here still now in New Zealand. We came back here. I feel some value in that, you know, growing up in familiar environment. It's something essential in that. There are people who choose to live in remote places for the rest of their life from where they grew up. And that's a whole, there's no right or wrong in this thing, but I choose to want to be connected to the landscape that I grew up in.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. I would just sort of, the last comment I'd like to make is, through one sort of theme with Crowded House for me, it's just been, you can't go to one of these shows and not have a good time. They're very, you know, you leave smiling. The audience always has a good time. I'm watching the video for Ojai and just smiling ear to ear, watching that little kid bounce around with your head. Thought it was really fun. I can't wait to hear the rest of the album. But congratulations on the new release, which again is coming out May 31st. Ojai, of course, is out now, and we'll look forward to seeing you on the road, Neil.
All right, fellas. Thank you very much.